Proverbs chapter 31. Because to me, I think this chapter gives a lot of latitude to women on what they can do in the home. This is the first thing that we're going to address is the home, and then we'll see a few things about the church. And what we want to do in the church is what we should do in the church. Whether it is or isn't, needed to. So back here in Proverbs 31, granted, this was written down during the time of Solomon, about approximately 3,000 years ago. But I think we're going to find some principles here that are, you might say, eternal. They go on and on and on, and they apply to women in the home and the family, regardless of whatever age you might live in. Okay, verse 10 of Proverbs 31 starts the theme that we want. And it says, who can find a virtuous woman? In other words, somebody that is valued, somebody that is upright, is moral, someone that is an asset to herself, or community, or family, or children, or husband. That's the theme that's being talked about. For her price is far above rubies. And I think it goes without saying that even the richest men in the world, like J. Paul Getty, for instance, who had his millions and billions, and who had six wives, incidentally, and said, I would give all my millions for one happy marriage. And I think you can find that the rich of the world would not have a virtuous woman for a wife, or maybe they weren't a virtuous husband that would have had a wife like that, but nevertheless, they would have given millions for one. Going on, the heart of her husband does safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. And of course, you get down to one aspect here that makes any marriage pick, and that is trust. When the husband doesn't have to be suspicious of what his wife is going to do or how much of his hard-earned income she's going to waste, or whatever the case may be, it's a trusting relationship. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. So you have a wife who is not trying to go counterproductive to her husband. She's trying to support him, trying to do him good, trying to help him out, and she does not have any motives of revenge or getting even or that type of thing. All right, now let's get into a few specifics here. Now these are talking, granted, about affairs that applied 3,000 years ago, but if we draw the principle from different verses here, I think we can see the latitude that women have today. It says that she seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands, and she is like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. Now obviously, the point here is that she is, yes, a hard worker, but she's also a woman who's not necessarily tied to the house. She gets out. She shops. She hunts for good bargains. She is out mingling with the populace, with the public around her. Because to be able to seek the wool, the flax, and working willingly with your hand, to be able to go out where the merchants are, and bringing food, as it says, from afar and underneath for the house and this type of thing, there is, again, nothing wrong with a woman being out and around. I can use that terminology. All right, going on a little further. She rises also while it is yet night, and she gives meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. So here's a woman that is industrious. She's not afraid to get out early in the morning to see her children off to school, to fix her husband breakfast. I guess in this case, she was rich enough to have servants and maidens and others in the house that worked with her. And as she made sure their needs were taken care of too. So this virtuous woman definitely had industry, she had energy, she had zeal. Maybe she was taking Jericho, I don't know. But nonetheless, she was willing to get out and get going. All right, verse 16. She considers, it says, a field, and lies it, and with the fruit of her hand she plants a vineyard. Now, to be able to consider a field and buy it, to me, supposes a couple of things. Number one, that she has a little business sense about her, and when she buys it, I take it that she also has a bank account of her own. She is maybe perhaps in a little bit of the real estate business, this type of thing. I think the principle we can extract from verse 16 is that a woman, rather than just necessarily concentrating all of her time at home, this woman had the latitude to go out and to buy and to sell and to consider, and perhaps use modern day language to have a little part-time work on the side, and perhaps making a buck as well. And from Proverbs 31 here, I see no problem, as long as other considerations are met, which we're going to see later on, for a woman, making a little income outside the house, Again, that's going to depend on the family circumstances, the age of the children, and all those factors. But this certainly brings that principle out, that she can be out considering things, buying things, doing business, in this type of situation. Okay, but now in the first, she girds her loins with strength, she strengthens her arms, she perceives that her merchandise is good, that her candle goes not out by night. Now this to me is an amazing woman. I don't think she does all this at one time, because I don't see how she can rise early in the morning and her candle doesn't go out at night, when she get any sleep. But obviously, I think the point is, when the need is there, she's willing to stay awake. When the need is there, she's willing to get up early. In other words, whatever her needs are, she is willing to be adaptable to make her household, her family, her husband, her children, her servants, whatever, go. That's the point I think the proverb is trying to bring out. Because all of us have physical needs, and you just can't burn the candle in both ends and get 2 hours of sleep a night and expect to last very long. So I think it just gives the contrast that she's willing to do whatever is necessary. So verse 19, she lays her hand in the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff, those spinning instruments. She stretches out her hand to the cord, yea, she reaches forth her hands to the knee. Now I think verse 20, to me, gives a little bit of an insight where she's involved in her community. And she sees people around her, maybe she's involved in whatever it might be, some local project at the school, some project with the civic group, what do they call this, the United Way, or the Red Cross, or again, some civic group, some church group that could use her services in helping out the poor, the needy, the sick, this type of thing. So again, I see no problem at all with women getting out, helping out in the community as their schedule would allow, being able to help the needy around them, take care of the needs of other people. No problem with that in the Word of God. All right, verse 21. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household, her clothing is scarlet, and she makes herself coverings of tapestry, her clothing is silk and purple. In other words, she makes sure that her needs are taken care of, her children have better clothing, that whatever the particular needs of the season are, that she sees that those needs are met. Verse 23. Now, being that she is the type of a woman we're reading about here, it would follow, I think, that verse 23, her husband is known at the gates, where he sits among the elders of the land. Apparently, he held a prominent position in society that this particular account was told about. She makes fine linen and sells it. There again, you're talking about a job. You know, she's making money, she's doing business. She delivers, it says, girdles or clothing in the market for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. Verse 26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. Now I would gather from this that she's going to open her mouth with wisdom. She has studied a little bit. She's been educated. She's taken some time to learn. And again, I see nothing wrong with women being able to take some classes, a little bit of college perhaps, finish her high school, go out and take maybe some night classes or something like that in some of the community colleges that are available, and being able to increase your wisdom, your knowledge, your store of information, so that you will know better how to fulfill your function in life. I think Proverbs 31 would allow that. Verse 27, she looks well to the ways of her household, and eats not the bread of idleness. In other words, she finds things to do to keep busy in a profitable way. And if there is one woman that I have heard among most wives today, particularly in God's church, but this is also in the world as well, is boredom. Boredom. My life has no fulfillment. You know, I get the dishes done, I get the kids off to school, I vacuum the floors, I dust the covers, or whatever the case may be. Now what do I do? Now, it's not that way every day, because some days there are things to do. Some days are busier than others. But all of you probably from time to time, it's not right now, maybe a year ago, maybe 6 months or a year from now, I think all of us suffer from this, is that you wonder, what should I do with my time? You don't know how, whether you want to step out and maybe take some classes, go get a part-time job, should you do this, do that, do something else. And even if you have little children at home, that sometimes compounds the problem. But because of those little children, you can't step out perhaps to take a class or go get a part-time job. And 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds aren't a whole lot of, stimulation, that's the word we're looking for. And then, of course, your husband comes home from work and you want to talk and he wants to sit and, we've all been through that syndrome. And you say to yourself, now, it's no wonder that I'm going downhill here. All I have is 2 or 3 year olds keeping occupied during the day, and so on. But anyway, this lady did whatever she needed to do, to keep busy, to make it a problem. And I guess she had the money and the attitude and the husband and the children where she could get out and around. She had a part-time job and she was involved in the community and certainly took care of her family. And I guess found plenty to do. Now, because of these things that she did, it says that her children arise up and they call her blessed. In other words, the children really hold her in high esteem. Her husband also does the same. He holds her in high esteem and really appreciates this virtuous woman that he has. And he praises her. Now, you probably think to yourself, yeah, if my husband did that to me, I might be more like the person who would do it. Praise me and set me up on high, and my children call me blessed, and so on. It says, many daughters have done virtuously, but you have excelled all. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. In other words, who approaches the job of being a wife and mother in a godly way, according to the principles of God. It says, give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. In other words, this woman has the character where you just turn her loose and let her go, and she will make her own reputation. And it'll be well known what she can do and what kind of character she has. All right, now these are just some of the highlights of this chapter in Proverbs 31 that I've gone over. But I bring these out because they show you the variety of things that a woman can get involved with that I think are going to have no contradiction in the Bible. We found out here that a woman could be involved in the community, that a woman could be involved in city projects, a woman could be involved in going far to buy and even to sell, a woman can have things that she's doing to make money, a woman can hold a job. These are different things that a woman can do. These are possibilities. But if you also notice in being there in Proverbs 31, the main thing always centers back with the woman's household. It's the household that we keep coming back to. Everything she does, she is doing for the benefit of her family, whether it be for her children, for her husband, for herself. All these things come back and find their focus in the family. And I think that's a key point. You find a woman who is virtuous, who is out doing things, but you don't find a woman who is working independent of her family. She's not what we would call a typical women's liver where she insists on her rights, she's going to go out and do her own thing, and her family can just go hang. She's going to do what she wants to do. That's not the attitude to find her. All right, now, I know that probably provokes a lot of thoughts, good, write them down, whatever. I'm going to hurry on some other scriptures here. I'd like you to go back to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. Because I want to dwell a little bit more on the home. And a scripture back here in Titus 2 that I think has probably caused a lot of maybe bad feelings, anger. I know it's probably been used as a club by husbands. But I think in the light of Proverbs 31, we might get a little better understanding of it. Let's go here in Titus chapter 2 toward the end of the New Testament. And verse 1. And this is Paul speaking to Titus, who was an elder in God's church in the Isle of Crete. He was giving him some instructions about what to pass along to different individuals in the church. And he said in verse 1, speak the things which become sound doctrine. So the verses that are going to follow here are what become sound doctrine according to God's word. And we'll just read what he says, and then we'll get down to verses 3 through 5, which I really want to dwell on. It says that the aged men, in other words, the older men, be sober, grave, temperate, sound in the faith, in love, and in patience. All right, verse 3, that the older women, likewise, that they be in behavior as become holiness, and not false accusers, not given to much wine, and teachers of good things. And that these older women, that they may teach the young women to be also sober, and that doesn't mean, alcohol, it just means sober-minded, wise. Level-headed, in other words, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home. We're going to get back to that. Good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blaspheming. Now, there are 2 or 3 or 4 things here that older women were to have a part in God's church in instructing the younger women. And yet I would dare say, and I'll throw out a rather bold statement here, that this kind of instruction from older women to younger women is almost non-existent in God's church. Almost non-existent. Now, why? Well, I think there are probably two or three reasons. One is probably there has not been a forum or a time or a place for older women to pass on the instruction. Secondarily, maybe the older women didn't feel they were qualified to pass on the instruction. And thirdly, maybe the younger women weren't particularly receptive to being instructed, if I could put it that way. And then again, maybe due to geography and distance, separation, time, and all this kind of thing that we just never have time to get together to be able to do. I don't know. But you see very little of that. But what for the younger women? Generally, I think the age classification here, a younger woman would be classified as any woman who still has children at home. An older woman here would be someone whose children have already grown up, and she is basically in the empty nest, you might say. Her children have grown up, established themselves somewhere else, and it's just her and her husband at home. So that would be the distinction. Now, the younger women, it says, should be level-headed. And they should be instructed to love their husbands. And again, this is a key point. Love their husbands. And notice it says their husbands. Not the ideal husband. See? Not the perfect husband. Not loving only if he does everything right. But you love your husband, the one that you have got, you see, the one that you chose to marry. Let's remember that. Now, granted, he's got his faults, he's got his problems, we all do. There's none that are perfect or anywhere close to it. But again, love their husband. That's one key obligation. Secondarily, the obligation is to love their children. Okay? That's a second obligation. And then if you go down a little bit further, the third obligation is found there, the word in verse 5, they are to be keepers at home. Does that mean they always stay at home? It doesn't say that. They make sure the house is kept. That is the key principle. Now granted, if you've got smaller children that are going to require more time, that are going to take more of your time and your circumstances to take care of, and your husband is out working during the day and so on. I think it's going to be an obligation of women while those children are smaller before they get into school that they're going to be spending most of their time at home to take care of their children. That doesn't mean that you can't turn your children over to a babysitter from time to time. I'm not saying that that is wrong at all. I think you have to maintain your sanity. You've got to get out of the house from time to time. Believe me, I know. I've got two kids. And it wasn't that long ago that they were preschool, and my wife was stuck home all night long with them. And I know what that situation is like. And I'm also a firm advocate that a husband should share the duties of child rearing and babysitting and those things with his wife. If you want to take that home and beat your husband over the head with it, take him home and beat him. Because I'll back you to know on that. I am not a believer that the wife is always stuck with the kids and the husband can go out and party and do what he wants and never, have any concern for his wife's needs. Nuts to that kind of thing. I believe the husband owes it to his wife to babysit the kids from time to time so she can go out and have a night with the girls if she would like. And if he has the type of job where maybe he can be home sometimes during the day and maybe she can go out and get a little part-time work to do something in the community, I'm all for that too. So I am not an advocate of the wife getting stuck. The husband has the obligation to see that those children are taken care of. Again, I want to make that point clear. But it says here in the book of Titus that the wife has the main obligation to be the keeper at home. To see that the house is kept, neat and clean, taken care of, the business finances and other things to afford, and also to see that those smaller children who are at home while they're at home are taken care of. That is one of the main obligations of the wife. So these are just, again, some overall principles. We can get into more detail in the discussion period, but certainly these are things that need to be brought out to show the obligation of a woman in the home and, of course, for her husband. Now, let's go to a couple of other scriptures. Back in 1 Peter chapter 3, moving back toward the end of your Bible, I want to read two verses here because I think they both couple together in thing. You can't properly understand one without the other. 1 Peter chapter 3, and let's take verse 1. You might think, oh, now he's clear this out, now here it comes. It says, likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands. And then it goes on to show the situation where you maybe are married to an unconverted maid, but if any, referring to the husbands, obey not the word. In other words, they're not in God's church. They also may, without the word, be won by the conduct of the conversation of the wives. Now, a point that I want to bring out here is, I can sympathize with women of liberation, I can sympathize with many of the rights that women have, but God so ordained that the husband is the head of the house. Now, does that mean, that the wife never makes a decision? Does that mean the wife has to fear everything to her husband and so on and so on? No. Let me tell you what I envisioned here. I think this is true. When I was taking marriage counseling classes on my sabbatical a couple of years ago, we had an outside marriage counselor who came in and gave us a couple of lectures. And he was talking about some of the problems that caused marriages to go bad. And he said that one of the key things that needs to be done in the early stages of a marriage is that roles need to be assigned in the marriage. In other words, who is going to be accountable for what? Who is going to take what responsibility? Who is going to, take these obligations and see that they're taken care of? And this is where marriage can be extremely flexible. Because you can have two people in a marriage where the wife has certain duties and the man has certain duties in that household. And they can be night and day in difference from somebody else's marriage. And both of them can be perfectly good marriages. In one household, the wife may pay all the bills and handle all the money. That's not a sin. It might just be a recognition that the wife is far better with mathematics and budgeting and maybe has a little bit better control over the money than the husband. Now, it doesn't mean that the husband has no input on how the money's spent. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's a recognition of who has the most talent and assigning a role to that talent so that talent can be utilized. But you see, the problem is with a lot of men is they suffer from an inferiority complex. They recognize their wife does have many talents. And they don't want to let that wife utilize those talents because they're afraid it's going to make them look bad. Let's be honest. And I think that's too bad. Really, I do. Because I am a firm advocate when you're working with people, whether that person you're working with is your own mate, your own family, or somebody in the church. If you search out who's not the talent and you build those talents to the other. And I've been married to my wife for 11 years, and anything I can find she can do, I make her do. And I'm not ashamed to say that maybe she can do things better than I can for her. Great, let her do it. See, because it's only going to come back and profit me. She can do it better than I can, if I let her do it, we both profit from. Why should I come with an inferiority complex and refuse to let her do something because I don't want to work? Why is it going to make me look bad? It's only going to make me look good if she does a good job in some areas of marriage, see. Now, you probably think, yes, can that tell my husband, would you? Let him know that. But I want you all to understand something. That the male ego has taken an enormous beating over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, an enormous beating. Some of it was deserved. It needed to be inflated quite a bit. Because the male, as we're going to see here a little bit later on, 1 Peter 3, had really served his duties and was not treating his wife like she ought to have been treated. So part of it was deserved. But also, you have to understand that there has been just a wholesale attack on the family, a wholesale attack on any kind of government in the family, a wholesale attack on the husband's part in the family, as the head of the house. And many husbands are so racked with inferiorities and complexes that it's all they can do to keep their place in the family. I've seen it time and time and time again. And generally, the husband is the last one to admit that, by the way. Now, I would say this, that a lot of husbands have been subject to bad family life when they grew up. They grew up with a domineering mother. They grew up with a weak father figure. They grew up with divorce and all other kinds of factors. They weren't taught how to be a good husband. They knew they had weaknesses and inadequacies, and instead of admitting those and working on them, what they decided to do when they became married was to put their wife down, and therefore that would keep them in their position. Because if they didn't keep that wife down, she's liable to rise up and look better than they did. They thought that would be bad. And so they fought the superiority over the years, and it's really taken its toll on the family. Verse 7, this is in Hebrews, directed toward others. And I'd like to make sure we all understand what this verse says. It says, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them, with your wives, according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife. Now it says, as to the weaker vessel. That does not mean women who are stupid or less intelligent or anything. I mean, well, you know, the weaker vessel is just an obvious physical fact that an average woman is weaker physically than an average man. That's all it means. Sure, you got strong women, you know, that I suppose have been pressed 500 pounds. But that's the rare exception. The average man is bigger physically than the average woman, is stronger physically than the average woman. That's all the term weaker vessel means. It's just giving it as just an obvious fact that most of us know. And as being heirs together of the grace of life. In other words, the whole purpose of life is, of course, making the kingdom of God. And a husband and a wife are heirs together. They're a partnership. They're a team that is striving to fulfill that goal. And it's not where one has the right to put the other one down, one has the right to lord over the other one. You have got a partnership, a team that ought to be working together to accomplish that end. Now, the point that needs to be brought out is that I think it's been running around too far here about marriage being equals, where we're a partnership, and everything is 50-50 and all that kind of stuff. Great. As long as we all agree, then there will never be any dispute. But what happens in marriage when we don't agree? With any type of situation where people are involved, whether it's a church or a government or a marriage or whatever, somebody has to make a decision when there's a disagreement. It has to be that way. Somebody is going to be in charge. And where you don't have anybody in charge, you have anarchy and confusion and total chaos, what you're going to have against it. And God so ordained it that the husband was in charge, and hopefully happened. The husband is going to be wiser and consider enough, where he recognizes that if there is a disagreement between he and his wife, he can have enough wisdom to listen to his wife's opinion and admit when he's wrong and she's right and do what she thinks wrong. But the husband still has that right in God's eyes, provided it doesn't, of course, cause the woman to sin. Then the woman has the right to decline, to go along with whatever it might be. We'll get into all of that in a minute. Now, I'd like to back that up with another scripture or two. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. And let's find that from the very creation, God set it up this way in the home. Genesis 3, verse 16. Here was instruction to the woman. And he says, unto the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and conception, in other words, and having children, and sorrow is to bring toward children. And the last part of the verse, and your desire shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you. See, when Paul says back in the book of Ephesians, or Peter says here in 1 Peter, that, you know, the husband is the head of the house, they didn't dream that up on their own. Because you'll find many modern-day theologians who will say that was Paul's opinion, or that was Peter's opinion, or that was John's opinion. That's not the way God intended. No, all the way back to the creation, God ordained the government into the home. The husband was to rule the wife. But the word rule is a tricky word, see. Because when we think of the word rule today, we think of somebody who's going to be some lord, a master over the household. That is not what God had in mind, as we saw here in 1 Peter 3, as we have seen in Proverbs 31. God ordained it to be a partnership with the two individuals along with their children who are working together to picture the kingdom of God. Now, how does God rule his church? Does he lord it over us and put us down and smash us and walk all over us and beat us with whips and humiliate us? God doesn't treat his church that way. He loves us, he nourishes us, he takes care of us, he sacrifices for us, he gives himself for us, Christ was willing to give his life for us. That's how Christ loves his church, and that's how a husband ought to love and rule his wife, the same way that Christ did his church. But unfortunately, most husbands don't measure up. That is, all of us don't measure up to that. You know, some visit further than others. But I'd like to again remind you of the fact that you are to be subject to your husband. And he's not fault, some more than others. take the situation that you have and make the best with it. And we'll get into a little bit about how in just a moment. But one of the scriptures, see if I can find them here. Yes, it needs to be brought up. There's a scripture back in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I'm going to kind of make a transition here. We're going to have a little overlap. We'll be getting into the woman's place in the church along with the home. So we're just going to kind of blend into the other subject that I promised to cover here. 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Now here is a section of scripture that at first looks like a woman that's nothing more than a slave. But I don't think it says that if you read it closely. 1 Timothy 2, starting in verse 9. She gets further education, and she goes out perhaps and gets a part-time job, and she gets involved perhaps in things in the community. And she makes sure that the needs of her family are taken care of. See, those are the good works that this woman who professes godliness is going to have to do. So a woman's role is not one of passive, stay home, do nothing, keep your mouth shut. That's not what God intended. All right, now to get the full understanding of what we just read here, let's go to 1 Corinthians 14. Where Paul is again talking, and we'll add a little bit more to it. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, and in verse 34 is what we want to start reading. 1 Corinthians 14:34. He says, "Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted, it says, unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also says the law." And the law he's referring to is the one we read back in Genesis chapter 3. "And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it's a shame for women to speak in the church." Now, all Paul is showing here is what should be allowed and not allowed in a formal church service. That's why we do not have women ministers, because as Paul plainly brought out, it's not God's intended purpose that the woman who serves authority over the man. We do not have women ministers, we do not have women elders, we do not have women who are in charge of churches. We do not have women who give sermonettes or sermons. So the preaching part, expounding the word, and taking care of the leadership roles in the church, Paul showed was on the man, not the woman. But now what does it mean the woman should keep silence? Obviously, you fellowship and you talk when you come into the church. I'm referring to the church here as a building. But when it comes down to the authority of the church and the speaking and the preaching, that is left to the man, the way God ordained it. However, when we have a Bible study, an open discussion, where we solicit questions, you're not teaching or usurping authority over somebody. You're merely asking questions and giving input or a minister in charge and so on. There is no problem with that. Neither is it wrong for a woman to teach silence to a class. See, now that's not usurping authority over a man, that's teaching children. And we read back in Titus that was one of the main responsibilities a woman had. Neither is it wrong for a woman to sing special music. That's glorifying God. That's not usurping authority over the man. Neither is it wrong to play the piano or do all kinds of things that women do in God's church today. The main prohibition is against holding an office where you're usurping authority over a man and doing the preaching. Those are the two things that Paul says through the inspiration of God a woman should not do. So I wanted to, clarify that point, lest there be, some confusion about the woman's place in the church. But I'd like you to go back to Philippians chapter 4. Because we're going to see that women, played a prominent place in the church in helping out to be the service in the time of Paul. Notice here in Philippians chapter 4. Verse 3. Kind of cutting in here in the context, but he's kind of mentioning different people. And he says, "I entreat you also through fellow workers, help those women which labored with me in the gospel, and with women also with others of my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life." So he's writing this letter to the Philippian church, and he's telling them to help those women who labored with me in the gospel. How would women labor with Paul in preaching the gospel? Now obviously we've already read that the women did not have a point or a place of actually doing the preaching. But you see, there are a lot of other support functions that women get involved with in the church that help to preach the gospel. And this is what Paul was obviously recognizing, that there were many women who helped him. If you make a study in the letters of Paul, and you don't even have to read all of those, just generally take the first few verses and the last few verses of each woman's letter, and you're going to find where Paul again and again and again recognized certain women for different things that they did. And you're going to find that women play a very prominent role in the church in Paul's time and had a very active part in helping those churches grow. But they were not conserving authority over man, and they were not preaching in the church. Those are the two things that Paul showed they did not have the right to do. But they were active in the church, and they were acting their part in seeing that the gospel was preached. Now I'll name a couple of three things here in just a second. Let's see if there's another scripture I want to turn to though before I got to that. All right, we'll mention a couple of three or four things here that I think, you know, obviously women can do to help the church and help further the gospel. The first thing, obviously, they can do is take care of their part in the home and see that their husband is inspired and their children are taken care of. And by setting a proper example in the family, because example sometimes speaks far more than any works or any words that you can do. But obviously, women can help out if they have a talent in singing, in the choir, especially music, playing the piano, different things along that line. Women can help out if they have an aptitude for teaching in our Sabbath school program, which I think is one of the most successful things that we do here in the Akron Church, and it is primarily taken care of by the women. I don't know whether that's just a traditional thing that women have always been teaching to small children, or maybe we just need to twist more men's arms, or maybe that just, I don't know what it shows. I would encourage more men to be Sabbath school teachers as well, but that's the second part. Women can also help out in numerous physical activities that the church does. From the planning of socials to helping out even at holy days, Passover, at different church functions and activities, many different things that we call upon ladies to do. And again, you can take something that's a church service. Let's take, for instance, the Passover. Now, obviously, the preaching of the Passover service is going to be done by the man. But past that, you have got women who are going to have to serve in the worship of the feet, women who are going to have to serve in areas that are going to be pertaining to the women on the Passover. You have women who are going to be taking care of different functions in a service like that, just as men things. For instance, on the night we must observe that we're going to have here at the hall, obviously, I probably will open it up with prayer, asking God's blessing on the service that evening, upon what we're doing, and maybe talk for a couple of minutes on what the meaning of the night is, but I have completely turned over the whole thing to women, to her. See? And if you think I'm going to sit back and do all the work, you probably learned that a long time ago. But they are taking care of all the details and much of the setup and much of the organization, and the credit for the evening on how successful it is will fall on the shoulders of women, not men. And again, you can go into countless activities in the church that we do, social and religious and otherwise, where women have a prominent part in helping and serving and in doing their part in sending and preaching the gospel. But you know, there's another area where I think women have a marvelous opportunity that they just do not follow up on. And that is, during the week, or even at church, of course, seeking out who needs some encouragement, who needs some help, who is sick. And during the week, taking it upon themselves to make telephone calls and to write some letters, some notes, this type of thing. And if they have the time, and maybe the transportation and the wherewithal to help the sick, the shut-in, the widow, the person who is not able to rightly take care of himself. And that's an area where I really don't think we use our creativity and our ingenuity near enough. And I would just admonish all of you to look around and see if you cannot find areas of service where you can help other families and other women and other, children, men, whoever, in that way, in God's church. Another thing that I think you can really have a prominent part in, and that's making new people feel at home when they come to church. Now, I'll tell one on my wife here that she just related to me secondhand, and I didn't know she had done this. But she was remarking to me after church services this past Sabbath that she noticed a woman just standing by herself in the hall who looked like she didn't know anybody and felt rather intimidated. So she said she screwed up enough courage to go up to this lady and introduce herself and see if she, could find out who she was. So she found the lady's name, and sure enough, she was a brand new lady, just been baptized in the last baptism she had, and really didn't know anybody. So she took another lady, and the two of them took it upon themselves to go and introduce this lady around. Now I'm sure that lady feels a whole lot more welcome than she did before when she was kind of standing forlornly there in the hall wondering, could she make some friends. Look, when you see individuals like that in church that you don't know, screw up your courage. Walk up to them. Introduce yourself. Who knows? Maybe there's someone that's been coming to church for 10 years and you'll be embarrassed if you ask them. That happens to all. Okay, fine. Swallow your pride and barely embarrass them. You found somebody new. But if they do happen to be somebody you haven't seen around, and they are somebody who is perhaps new for the first or the second or the third time, you have one marvelous opportunity. By your example and by your concern, to really help somebody else fit into God's church. Because you see, I'm only at the beginning of the one. And I will go and visit a person perhaps for the first time, I will invite them to church, and then I come here and I've got dudes on the Sabbath, and I cannot see that all those new people are made welcome. That's where you have got to take it upon yourself to follow up with those obligations. And again, it's just another area where you can serve and you can be an active, integral part. In doing the work in the church. Okay, hold your question there. I don't want to sit on your enthusiasm, but I have a couple of three more things I want to say, and then we'll throw it over here and give you plenty of time. One of the scriptures I want you to turn to is back in Luke chapter 14. And this is going to be an introduction to how to handle situations with unconverted brothers. In other words, your obligation to the church as opposed to perhaps an unconverted husband, unconverted other relatives, children who maybe aren't interested, that type of thing. Luke chapter 14. And here we're going to read three verses, starting in verse 26. Luke 14, starting in verse 26. It says here that if any man, and it can refer to a woman as well, come to me, in other words, they want to be my disciple. And it says hate, but it means love not less by comparison. His father, mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters, yes, and even his own life. He cannot be my disciple. And whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Now go down a little bit further to verse 33. It says, so likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsakes not all that he has, he cannot be my disciple. In other words, doesn't have that willingness with God first. Now I wanted to read those three verses to give this kind of a backdrop to what I'm going to say, because I want to address a couple of three questions here. I hope that many of you sitting here, you have a situation where your husband is not in the church. And many times we will preach sermons and give Bible studies that are always from the backdrop of an ideal circumstance when the husband is in and the wife is in and the children are interesting, and that's real hunky-dory, you see. But what if it's the case where, the wife is in and the husband is not? Then what happens? All right, here's the principle that you're going to have to use. There has to be a certain bare minimum standard that you are going to have to live up to, even if your husband is not in the church. If your husband is going to stand in the way of you obeying God at a certain bare minimum level, you're going to have to be willing to stand your ground and bear the consequences. Now, I know that may sound like a hard statement, and let me expound on it a little bit. If your husband is going to ask you to do something that's sin, it's thumbs down your husband. I'm sorry. If he wants you to lie to cover up for his mistakes, if he wants you to cheat, if he wants you to steal, if he wants you to commit adultery, if he wants you to trample all over God's Sabbath day, I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. I just am not going to do it. And that's the way it's got to be, because Jesus Christ said, if you're going to come and be my disciple, you've got to put me first above everybody. And that includes an unconverted man. Now, let's take the other side of the coin, however, because I have noticed many times that I do not think wives as well as husbands can use the greatest amount of tact and wisdom. And they have put their husbands or their wives through things that they should not have put them through. And they should have been far more condescending and far more, bending over backwards to accommodate the fact that their mate did not see eye to eye with their religion. God does say, come to church, come to sanctuary. He does say, attend the holy days. But God does not say you have to attend every Bible study, every church function, every club, and every activity that the church puts on. And many times, perhaps, you're going to have to miss a church activity that you may want to go to, in order to accommodate your husband's needs in some other area, so he's not going to be so mad when you come to the required activity, such as a Sabbath day service or a holy day service. So you're going to have to realize that if your mate is not in the church, you may have to miss out on certain fringe benefits that God's church offers to satisfy his needs and to help him feel a part of my faith. Now, let me give you a word of caution. A lot of times, you're going to be married to a husband that is going to squat regardless of what you do. Now, if by going to a church activity, he's going to squat, and by staying home, he's going to squat anyway, and you're going to have to listen to the squats as it is, then why not go to the activity? Do you know what I mean? I mean, if that's the type of situation you're in. But if you can really bend over backwards and help accommodate him and please him by staying home from some fringe area of the church, then maybe the best thing for you to do until he softens up a little bit is to stay home. And I think that's the only approach you can take. But if he's going to gripe and bellyache and complain no matter what you do, then why don't you go to the church activity and have fun yourself if he doesn't want to come? If that's all he's going to do, squat when you get home and squat when you stay home. You may as well be practical about the whole thing. All right, now, what about other relatives besides the husband? Because this comes up quite often, you know, where aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, parents, grandparents, they put the pressure on. And maybe it's not your husband putting the pressure on, it may be all the in-laws. How far should you go to accommodate in-laws? Same principle applies. If you have to miss out on a fringe benefit to do certain things with your relatives. And I realize that many of you, by coming into God's church, have been cut off from your relatives because you no longer keep Christmas with them. You no longer celebrate Easter with them. You no longer go to church on Sunday with them. You know, you go to all these funny holy days. You're not around on Saturday, which is maybe a big day for getting the family together. And they blame it all on you, the family, and disintegrating, and it's all your fault. Well, maybe that's partially true. And if to make up for those problems, you can see them at other times during the week, and maybe have to visit church functions to do it, then maybe you should try to accommodate those unconverted relatives who don't see eye to eye with your religious beliefs. But again, if you're going to go to their house and do nothing but suffer ridicule, and they're going to put you down and make fun of you and lambast you if you're serving no good whatsoever by, you know, missing the church function to go there, then I wouldn't put up with that. I just wouldn't put up with it. And I'll tell you why, relatives, if they ever push me, they're in for a world. They never push me. I think they recognize that fact. Because I will not let an unconverted relative or a converted relative, it makes no difference to me, rule my life. I want to be emphatic about that point. And it makes me mad and sick the way I see some relatives treat other relatives. And it ought not be. They ought. And it ought not be. They dominate them. They expect them to come and cater to everything that's always been done in the family. And you try to exercise a little freedom on your own, they think you're some heretic. You're breaking the family apart. It's all your fault. Wrong. They've only got an inferiority complex 10 miles long that they're trying to serve and they're trying to get you to serve for. And you may think I'm mad about that issue. I am. Sometimes the way I see people treat other people. And it's only out of a selfish motivation. So I want you to get the balance here. If you do have relatives that are outside the church, yes, you do have an obligation to bend over backwards to try to accommodate those relatives and to try to keep a family together. Because let's never forget God puts the biggest emphasis in this life on the family. And many times he doesn't call all the family, meaning grandparents and aunts and uncles and children and all the rest. And if you can do things to keep your family together and keep that before a family, then do it. Even if it means sacrificing some of the things you might be able to do in the church. A lot of those things, of course, aren't sin. I mean, it's a matter of whether I can't come to church. When I come to church, I don't care what the government's saying. But it's a matter of things that you might have to sacrifice to accommodate them too. But if by trying to accommodate the relatives, all you meet is with flack and ridicule, and they make fun of you and run you down, and it's not doing any worthwhile good, then forget. You know, you may as well recognize the fruits of what they are, not cut yourself off in the church, because it's not going to do any good to try to accommodate those brothers. I mean, if they're just going to be mad to spite you, well, then tough. I mean, that's, I don't know any other way you can look at it. That doesn't mean you hate them when you look down upon them and you rub their nose at them. I'm not advocating that. But you may as well, you know, recognize the facts of what they are. So, you know, just a couple of guidelines there. Another thing I'd like to bring out in regard to children. As your children get older, especially up into the older teenage years, they may come to the place where they no longer want to have a part in God's family. And I'd like to bring out here that when a child gets to 15, 16, 17, 18 years of age, and they become hard-headed about it, they absolutely don't want to come to church, then I personally feel as a minister they should not be made to come. Because they're only going to make your life miserable and probably everybody else's life miserable around them when they do show up. And there's no sense pushing the issue any further. Now, I would also, on the other extreme, like to encourage all of you to try to involve your children as much as is possible in those activities that the church provides for children. Rather than the Sabbath school program, or town shows, or basketball, or cheerleading, or track and field, or whatever it might be. Because we have tried to design the why we do the things we do with our children, to keep your children in a physical way interested in the church, hopefully keep them around long enough until they get a little bit up here, so they would be interested from a mental and a spiritual, you know, point of view. And that was one, of course, of the reasons why we do was the divide in the first place. So try to do your part, perhaps, to find them a little transportation, and maybe sacrificing a little of your time to be able to get the children involved in some of the activities that might keep them drawn with the church. Okay, let me look over here. I might have another thought or two on this, and I want to bring out, and then we'll open it up to discussion here. Children, relatives, but with different levels of interest in church. You may have a husband or a wife who wants to attend every function the church puts out, and you have another lady who's also in the church, but only wants to go out to reward. I mean, this is a fact of life in many marriages. I recognize this. What should you do? Maybe you're the lifeguard that wants to go to everything, and your husband doesn't, or maybe he's the lifeguard that wants to go to everything, and you don't. The key factor here is compromise. Well, you've got to recognize the personalities of different individuals and how much they want to get involved with it. And compromise and try to work out some system with your mate where you can do some of the things you want to do, he can do some of the things he wants to do, and we can help mutually scratch each other's back, if I can put it that way. I don't think there is any pat answer to that. And another thing I'd like to bring out here is we do not expect, when we have an activity for the church, that everybody's going to be interested in. See, the Sabbath and the holy days are a commandment. Everything else is optional, really. I mean, we would hopefully encourage that as many women as possible who want to be part of women's club. We could get as many people as we could to come to a Bible study, as many teenagers as possible to be in YOU. But we recognize everybody's interests are not going to lie in the functions that we provide as a church. And it's no sin to stay home from the social if it just really doesn't interest you. You've got something else you feel to better use your time. That's not a sin. It's not necessarily wrong. However, for the purpose of unity, we would hopefully encourage as many people as we can, because I think every opportunity we can get together as a church, we can encourage each other and inspire each other, we're all going to be better off here. So again, I'm not putting down socials. I'm merely saying you're going to have to look at your own situation and weigh it accordingly. Okay, I realize I've given a shotgun approach to a woman's obligations at home to her husband, to the church, to do in the church, how perhaps to deal with unconverted mates and unconverted relatives and the eye to eye review. And I know I've left a lot of anything in, and perhaps some controversy and whatever. But I said my piece for the moment. Now I want to open it up to you, and you start expressing what's on your mind and what I provoke you to think about. And we'll go from there. First question. Okay, Mr.
Jessica.
Okay, you were talking about
the
men's people. Yes.
They've been having trouble with people in the community here. Right. Well,
my husband has said for years,
I can
do
everything he can do, and I
don't
do anything
he
can't do. He's
a
chill.
Ah, okay.
But he
and
he has to say, oh, I can do anything
I want
with him.
I'll be very honest with you. I would say, fine, that's your opinion. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. That's how I cope with it. You know, I wouldn't cope with it at all. You see, and again, don't feel like you have to pick on your individual husbands. You know, if you want to use them as an example, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine too. But my point here is that every individual is going to have opinions about certain things. And I'm talking about the certain things being a marriage and how a marriage ought to work and what a husband ought to do and a wife ought to do and so on. Some of that will be determined by what they have been taught in the church, but a big percentage of it will be determined on how they were brought up. And also, you know, also another factor I'd like to recognize, it will also be determined by their longevity in the church. The longer a man has been in the church, probably the harder he will come down on his wife. And I think the reason is obvious. Because when you go back 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, let's face it, the man was Lord and Master in God's church. And many men carry over things that they were taught by the church in those years, and old ideas die hard. I'm not trying to get all the old ideas to die that the church taught 15 or 20 years ago. I'm merely trying to modify them, that's all. And maybe bring them a little bit more out of date and back off from some of the extreme positions we took in the past. But in answer to your question, I wouldn't worry about it. I would do what you're good at. I would try to do everything you can do to make your family go. And if your husband likes to do certain things around the house and he feels that he can do them as good as you can, let him say you some words. But that's my own advice.
Back to my thing, but another to the family. Are there any statistics out now about how the YU program is affected the amount of children staying in the church compared to the full head YU program?
No. I don't think so. To my knowledge, the program hasn't, so to say, gone off long enough to be able to do that. We've only been in real operation about 3 years. And I think the acid test for YOU will come when you take the children that were 12 or 13 when the program started and see what's happened to them 6 and 7 and 8 years later when they become 17 and 18 and 19. Because a lot of times, YOU has picked up individuals of 17 or 18 or 19 who were already children. And they played basketball or rock lobs and cheerleaders and did whatever YOU had to offer because it was something they liked to do. But they were only using it because it was what they wanted to do and it didn't really affect them that much. So I think we're going to have to take it 5 or 6 years down the line if we're still here and then ask the question, how does it impact us today? Yes. Right. Well, yes. Right. Well, you know, it was like a minister I worked with about 7, 8, 9 years ago in New Jersey. He had a unique approach to Bible studies. This is what he told the congregation. He said that Bible studies are a commanded convocation. Now, of course, everybody looked at him and said, you can't prove it. And this is the look that some had on the picture. His report was this. He said, look, Mr. Herbert Armstrong has given me the job of pastoring this flock in this area. He has given me the job of organizing activities and social and Bible studies and things like that in this area for the good of all of you. And he has given me the right to call certain activities and so on for your benefit. We have called a Bible study. We have called a time to know when you're to come and be taught more about the Word of God. Now, if you respect, he said, the authority of God's church, and the right that I have been given through Jesus Christ by Mr. Armstrong to call this meeting for your good, you would be there. And that was his way of reasoning. I don't necessarily take exception, but I recognize several factors in regard to Bible study. I'll be real honest with you here from the minister's point of view. First of all, obviously, a Bible study is not a commanded convocation from the point of view that you have thus saith the Lord. Sabbath is the holy days only. However, it does say in the Bible in an overall sense that a minister should preach the word in season and out of season. He should teach, he should educate. One of the qualifications of an elder is he is apt to teach. And a beautiful opportunity is in a Bible study when you can get together and have people come and you can teach them. So I think Bible studies are definitely encouraged from the Bible and they are biblical. I also recognize, however, you have situations where you have children who go to school, you have distance to travel, you have husbands who work second shifts, where you have a problem with finances and being able to pay the gas to get there. I recognize where you have weather interferences and a lot of other things. And I know those things limit attendance at Bible study. And I also recognize the second factor that the burden lies on myself and on Mr. Frost and other ministers, where we have got to compete with Charlie's Angels and Ages and Odds and all these other factors, and we have got to put something in Bible study that is as interesting or more interesting than those shows to get you to come. And I believe that's an obligation on our part. And I also believe it's an obligation on all of your parts to examine your hearts if you don't come to Bible study and ask yourself, why don't I? Why don't I? Is it because my husband works the second shift? Is it because my children need to get their sleep and they go to bed at 8 o'clock at night and have a drink and they're on drugs and it's a waste of time, I can't get anything out of it anyway? Is it because we're so scrapped we can't afford the gas to come? Or is it because I just genuinely don't care? Or maybe it's because my husband doesn't care and I can't go myself and he won't go with me. Maybe that's the case. You search your heart and answer that question. And that's the, you know, the answer to it. But if I can get back to your original question about it being, it was almost magic 10, 15 years ago. Why isn't it now? I think it's a point of view where the church has come to adopt in certain areas like this a little bit more free moral agency. Well, we're going to put it out in front of you, and you're going to have to develop your own character, stand on your own 2 feet when you're going to put it in by the mouth. That is, you know, what has happened with a lot of different things in the church. Now, I also feel that you're going to see a swing going the other way. Because I think we reached the absolute outside liberalism, do what you want for about 6 months ago, 8 months ago. And I think from now on, you're going to find Mr. Herbert Armstrong coming down harder and harder and harder and harder on the obligations he feels that each of us have as Christians. And I think you're going to see